Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we do have the Pennsylvania debates. We'll get into those. I just got a couple obligatories and make a couple comments real quick. And then we'll get back into where we left off. Now, first off, on our YouTube channel, y'all just got to do a search for Reclaiming the Republic in YouTube and just subscribe to our channel there. They're technically calls, but I think I hear a phone ringing in the distance, but technically, these shows, these episodes will be uploaded so that you will actually be able to go through these things. And as soon as we're done with the Pennsylvania debates, I will create the PDF and we'll upload the Pennsylvania debate. And then we'll do the Massachusetts and so forth. So that way you can kind of go through and read along. And we've got it already highlighted. So, you know, you can jump down to the next section and read along with us so that you can actually read the exact same stuff. So you can, you know, acknowledge and affirm, you know, what these guys actually, how they define the Constitution. We're not making this stuff up. And so, Monix, if you go to the Take Action page, you'll find the information for Monix for those of you who are looking for it. And our national call will be tonight, and it's really for leaders. We'll be opening it and we're happy to open it if you want to ask a question, if you want to get involved at the national level, because there's a likelihood that you may be in a state. And if you are from a state that's actually there and represented, you'll be introduced to who you can be working with. So the national call is tonight. If you send us an email or give us a phone call, it's kind of late to possibly get in today, but because I've just got a lot on my plate. But, you know, it's always best to try. Because that way, if you try, then we, you know, you give us the opportunity to succeed. Anyway, we've got some, hopefully we'll be getting some more petitions coming up, and we'll be talking about that in the call tonight. But other than that, I think I'm ready. And as a matter of fact, we got Paul Venable with us. And Paul, I can tell you, you were sorely missed. I haven't told everybody, but I kind of have alluded to the fact that I started some medication, and it's the prednisone type of stuff that, you know, kind of helps your body recover. And what it does is it causes my head and my lips to kind of get out of sync. And so I have a hard time reading a little bit, but I mean, I can pull through, and I'm going to pull through, and that's what the great ones do. But, and not that I'm a great one, but anyway, I really appreciate you being here, and we really love the assistance that you're providing with reading. Are you ready to go?
Well, I'm glad to be back, GR. Thank you. And yes, we're ready to go.
Okay. And, well, is there anything that we've read so far, and anything that, you know, you've gotten out of the Pennsylvania debates that you would like to, you know, kind of comment or highlight or what have you?
Let's just get into it. I've been pretty involved in a couple things, some legislative alert we have here. And so, let's just get into the debates. I think they're pretty germane to what's going on today, and great guide for self-governance and the viewpoint of the framers.
Okay. Well, all right. Well, we're synchronized already from where we left off. And where we left off, folks, just so you know, Mr. McKean kind of shows up at the very end in a long dissertation. And at the very end, we already covered all of the arguments against the Constitution. What he did was kind of summarize them. And then he, you know, listed them out, and I forget how many there were, But now he's responding with his own words as to refuting these arguments against the Constitution. And so with that, we'll just go ahead and pick up with the president is to nominate to, and go. So go ahead, Paul.
All right, here we go. The president is to nominate to office and, with the advice and consent of the Senate, appoint officers so that he is the responsible person. And when any such impeachment shall be tried, it is more than probable that not one of the Senate who concurred in the appointment will be a senator, for the seats of a third part are to be vacated every 2 years, and of all in six. As to the senators having a share in the executive power, so far as to the appointment of certain officers, I do not know where this restraint on the president could be more safely lodged. Some may think a privy counselor might have been chosen by every state, but this could little amend the matter, if any, and it would be a considerable additional expense to the people. Nor need the state be under any necessity of sitting constantly, as has been alleged, for this is an express provision made to enable the president to fill up all vacancies that may happen during their recess, the commissions to expire at the end of the next session. As to the impeachments, the objection is much stronger against the Supreme Executive Council of Pennsylvania. The House of Lords in Great Britain are judges in the last resort in all civil cases, and besides, have the power of trying impeachments. On the trial of impeachments, the senators are to be under the sanction of an oath or affirmation. Besides the other, lies upon them to do justice, and the basis is more likely to be against the officer accused than in his favor, for there are always more persons disobliged than the contrary when an office is given away, and the expectants of office are more numerous than the possessors. Fourth, that Congress may by law deprive the electors of a fair choice of their representatives by fixing improper times, places, and modes of election. I've got to, Jerry, you don't mind if I stop there for a minute?
Okay. Well, so, okay. Yeah, go ahead. And what's up?
I think this is something that we're seeing, mm-hmm, in terms of choosing places of elections. It almost modes, place, and times and places and manner of election. I think that we see the feds trying to mess with this in multiple ways today, and so. So the states have a power. In fact, I don't know if you've heard this term being bandied about now called the independent legislature theory. They're starting to float this trial balloon, and it's coming from progressives. And, you know, where's this idea that legislatures are independent? Well, it comes from the Constitution. Okay.
Right,
and
right.
So I just thought I would add to that.
Right.
That
so
comes to mind.
Okay, so let me jump back, because you use the word besides the other lies upon them to do justice. Actually, it's ties. The word was ties, and what they were really trying to say there was that the oath or affirmation ties them. It basically bounds them to do justice, and so one of the things that is really huge that I don't think I've ever really made a big point of pointing this out, other than the fact that, you know, we've kind of talked about it and we've, you know, the premise of Republic Review and so forth. But over the past year, and since I was writing the petitions article, in other words, the work I've been doing on First Amendment petitions and so forth that I still haven't published, it has jumped out how significant the oaths of office are here in America, where it is not done anywhere else. And so this right here is something that really starts jumping out. And it's it's really jumping out more this time through here, folks. And so one of the things that we're finding is in state constitutions, we're coming across states that don't have good ties to their oath of office and, you know, holding the public servants accountable to this legally binding oath. Bottom line, it doesn't matter whether that you have that in the Constitution. They are legally bound. But it's nice, and we need to actually make sure that every state constitution is amended or it is included in the next writing of the Constitution, that all public servants are legally bound and obligated to support the Constitution. They don't have a choice. And so, anyway, yes, getting back to this election point, though, you're absolutely right. The states do have full control. The problem is that just in case there is a necessity because states can't necessarily do it, they included in the Constitution that the federal government can at times determine when the election will be and when, you know, the place and time, just that overall election administration. They have no control over how the election is conducted, only the administrative scheduling type of thing of the election. Does that make sense?
And that does make sense. There needs to be kind of some uniformity across the states for when, but the manner is up to the states, and that's understandable.
Right. Okay. So anyway, I will let you go ahead and start off again with every House of Representatives are of necessity. So they're talking about the state houses, by the way, here. So go ahead. Go ahead. Take off there.
Every House of Representatives are of necessity to be the judges of the elections, returns, and qualifications of its own members. It is therefore their province as well as duty to see that they are fairly chosen and are the legal members for this purpose. It is proper they should have it in their power to provide that the times, places, and manner of election should be such as to ensure free and fair elections. Annual Congresses are expressly secured. They have only a power given them to take care of the elections shall be to take care that the elections shall be at convenient and suitable times and places and conducted in a proper manner. And I cannot discover why we may not entrust these particulars to the representatives of the United States with as much safety as to those of individual states. In some states, the electors vote viva voice, in other words, by ballot. They ought to be uniform and the elections held on the same day throughout the United States to prevent corruption or undue influence. Why are we to suppose that Congress will make a bad use of this power more than the representatives of the several states? It is said, quote, that the powers of Congress under this Constitution are too large, particularly in laying internal taxes and excises, because they may lay excessive taxes and leave nothing for the support of state governments, end quote. Sir, no doubt, but you will discover on consideration the necessity of extending these powers to the government of the Union. If they have to borrow money, they are certainly bound in honor and conscience to pay the interest until they pay the principal as well to the foreign as to the domestic creditor. It therefore becomes our duty to put it in their power to be honest. At present, sir, this is not the case, as experience has fully shown. Congress has solicited and required the several states to make provision for these purposes. Has one state paid its quota? I believe not one of them. And what has been the result? Foreigners have been compelled to advance money to enable us to pay the interest due them on what they furnished to Congress during the late year. I trust we have had experience enough to convince us that Congress ought no longer to depend upon the force of requisition. I heard it urged that Congress ought not to be authorized to collect taxes until a state had refused to comply with this requisition. Let us examine this position. The engagements entered into by the general government render it necessary that a certain sum shall be paid in 1 year. Notwithstanding this, they must not have power to collect it until the year expires, and then it is too late. Or is it expected that Congress will borrow the deficiency? Those who lent us in our distress have little encouragement to make advances again to our government, but give the power to Congress to lay such taxes as may be just and necessary, and public credit will revive. Yet, because they have the power to lay taxes and excise, does it follow that they must? For my part, I hope it may not be necessary, but if it is, it is much easier for the citizens of the United States to contribute their proportion than for a few to bear the weight of the whole principal and interest of the domestic debt. And there is perfect security in this head, because the regulation must equally affect every state, and the law must originate with the immediate representatives of the people, subject to the investigation of the state representatives. But is the abuse an argument against the use of power? I think it is not. And upon the whole, I think this power wisely and securely lodged in the hands of the general government, though, on the first view of this work, I was of opinion they might have done without it. But, sir, on reflection, I am satisfied that it is not only proper, but that our political salvation may depend upon the exercise of it.
Okay, so let me just inject something here, because up above, when there's this comment in this top of the paragraph that you just read, there's this little part: if they have to borrow money, they are certainly bound in honor and conscience to pay the interest until they pay the principal, as well to the foreign as to the domestic creditor. Now, what really jumped out, and what they didn't mention, because, you know, the issues were brought up in different ways, and this was strictly just about credit and spending and borrowing. The assumption is that the federal government can only spend money on the enumerated powers. They cannot borrow money to spend on something they have no power. In other words, this is why we go through the Supremacy Clause, and clearly it basically talks about treaties can only be made that are under their authority. They cannot usurp authority and make a treaty. They have no power to do that. What is a line of credit? What is a loan between one country and another country? It is a treaty. It is a compact. Same. It falls under contract law. Does the federal government have the authority to borrow money to spend on the generation of COVID vaccines? No. Does it have the authority to borrow money like the Build Back Better infrastructure and, you know, and the spoil systems and everything else that they have been spending? If you go through the 30 some trillion dollars that have been spent, because you got to remember, folks, the federal government on an annual basis for quite a while has been basically bringing in $2 trillion of legitimate revenue from you, the taxpayers, from the yoke that they have put upon us. So in other words, we've been paying legitimate taxes, and actually when you look at the outlays of the legitimate government, our taxes have been more than satisfactory to pay for the obligations of government. However, government is usurped and assumed, and they're deliberately and recklessly going down this path of creating so much debt that they're putting us in harm's way. Why is this so important? And I'm going to tell you, folks, it is to destroy us. This is the warfare. This is why, I don't know if you caught my Monday shows, but I'm using my Monday shows as the game changer. I am laying out and connecting the dots of how this warfare that we're under is being used against us. And so we're being put into a position, folks, where we now have, you know, the government in its final positions getting ready to actually seal the deal. In other words, they've got the three walls up in the forest and they've got a big trough of food for us, the pig, to come, you know, eat up this last helping so that they can put the fourth wall up and we're done. This is why it is now or never. That wall isn't up. We still have the opportunity. And your state houses, your state legislatures are the critical key in stopping all of it. Anyway, so forgive me. We can go ahead and get back to the next objection is against the power. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Am I on?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And we've got about 3.5 minutes, so we'll just kind of plow away until I kind of have to interrupt you. Go ahead.
Okay. I can get to this one.
Yep.
The next objection is against the power of raising and supporting armies, and the appropriation of money for that use should not be for so long a term as 2 years. Is it not necessary that the authority superintending the general concerns of the United States should have the power of raising and supporting armies? Are we, sir, to stand defenseless amidst conflicting nations? Wars are inevitable, but war cannot be declared without the consent of the immediate representatives of the people. They must also originate the law which appropriates the money for the support of the army. Yet they can make no appropriation for a longer term than 2 years. But does it follow, because they may make appropriations for that period, that they must or even will do it? The power of raising and supporting armies is not only necessary, but is enjoyed by the present Congress, who also judge of the expediency or necessity of keeping them up. In England, there is a standing army, though in words it is engaged but for one year, yet is it not kept constantly up? Is there a year that Parliament refuses to grant them supplies? Though this is done annually, it might be done for any longer term. Are not their officers commissioned for life? And when they exercise this power with so much prudence, shall the representatives of this country be suspected the more because they are restricted to 2 years? Help us understand what he's saying here in this paragraph, maybe after the break, because this is a mouthful.
Well, so actually we've got a little over a minute. So what they're really talking about is the argument is against the power of raising armies and supporting them beyond 2 years. And one of the things that they really didn't get into clarity is that the army, because he didn't do a good job in identifying that the army in England is a permanent army. It is not an army that comes by requisition to the militia. So this is why the next part is where they actually connect the militia to the army. Technically, Congress does not have the power to create a permanent army, or let me be very clear, a department of army, because they're supposed to be limited by 2 year requisitions. They're only to have the army formed when the army is necessary for fighting. The army has no constitutional role. In other words, the federalized militia is not within the constitutional framework for using the federalized militia as a force of peacekeeping in Germany or occupying space, you know, post-war in Japan. The Navy has a permanent position with the Marine Corps. So if they were going to follow the Constitution, they would have deployed Marines on land forces and land bases. And so we're coming into the break right now, but bottom line, they would have been deploying the Marines on land bases and the Navy on sea bases and, you know, seaports to ensure that force projection for keeping the peace or what have you would have been maintained so that the Army could go back to the states and no longer be federalized. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so let me just kind of bring everybody back, or coming back from the break, let me kind of get back to what I was going to say when we ran out of time. So in the Virginia debates, again, Mason wanted amendments regarding the control over the militia. He saw that the desire of creating a standing army, because in their terms, in the Virginia ratification debates, they clearly spell out that the king used this army, this federalized army that became permanent. It was his men that were guarding the castle and so forth. He also used them to enforce federal law against the people. You know, I don't want you hunting in my forest. I don't want you doing this. In other words, it wasn't for the purpose of national defense as much as it was for enforcing his desires upon the people. Now, in the Constitution, it was this is really, really clear in the Virginia ratification debates that the only force that has the ability to actually execute the laws of the Union are the militia when they're federalized. And the only reason for federal, you know, for calling forth the federal militia would be to execute the laws of the land under those in pursuant. So when you look at the laws that we have federal enforcement agencies, FBI, so forth and so on, we'll realize that where did the enumerations and the powers, because remember, the FBI and the ATF was really created because of prohibition and it was all about enforcing alcohol laws. Well, when we overturned that, did they get rid of the FBI and the ATF? No. They created a standing army in this thing called the FBI to enforce law instead of, and technically, if you go back to the Prohibition Amendment, it doesn't grant them the power to create an enforcement agency. It basically states that they have the Congress have the power to make law to actually enforce these regulations and so forth. And so to be clear here, folks, when we look at what the federal government has done is they've bypassed the instructions or the design of the Constitution when it comes to enforcing a legitimate federal law, that they can only do this by deploying the militia. So does that help make sense? Paul?
Are you asked? Oh, yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, it definitely
right.
helps.
Okay,
sense.
Great. All right. So go ahead and pick up, because the next objection, because that's, I think, where he kind of now weaves into his argument with the militias.
Correct. So okay. Here we go. It is objected that the powers of Congress are too large because, quote, they have the power of calling forth the militia on necessary occasions and may call them from one end of the continent to the other and wantonly harass them. Besides, they may coerce men to act in the militia whose consciences are against bearing arms in any case, end quote. It is true by this system, powers given to Congress to organize, arm, and discipline the militia. But everything else is left to the state governments. They are to officer and train them. Congress have also the power of calling them forth for the purpose of executing the laws of the Union, suppressing insurrections, and repelling invasions. But can it be supposed they would call them in such case from Georgia to New Hampshire? Common sense must oppose this idea. In another objection was taken from these words of the Constitution, quote, to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers and all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States or in any department or office thereof, end quote. I kind of segued right into necessary and proper. So
yeah, we'll that's absolutely fine, because this is all, you know, a long diatribe. Again, like right. I said, he created this long list of, okay, so this, here's your primary objectives. Now, if you notice, we're towards the very end of the Pennsylvania ratification debates, and McCain was basically, you know, mustering up this final argument to basically refute every single that they may still want to hold on to an argument against the Constitution. And so he lays out the clarity, or, you know, stipulates how these things were to be defined. And right. in so doing, he did that. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, basically what he just, what you just read regarding the militia is precisely what I was basically alluding to, that they only have the power to utilize the militia when they need to execute the laws of the Union. But, you know, when you look at many of the laws, like I'll give you an example, environmental protection, is that mm-hmm. constitutional?
No.
Can they call up the militia to execute laws regarding the environment?
Well, there's nowhere in Article 1, Section 8 where they have the authority to do that.
Right. So, but my point is, when you look at all the different standing armies, the federal government usurped authority. And then instead of saying, well, but we want the states to enforce this, because had they done that, it wouldn't have taken long for the states to actually realize, hey, what you're doing right. is not constitutional, and you have no right federalizing. So what they right. did was they got everybody. Because, see, when the federal government starts involving everybody in their lives, then mm-hmm. everybody starts, you know, hey, what's going on here? But if the federal right. government just goes off and does these things on their own, then it doesn't create suspicion.
Correct. So they created a standing army called the EPA,
right?
With enforcement powers,
like the ATF. They created a standing army, like the Forestry Department and the Forestry mm-hmm. Rangers. They created a standing army in agriculture. They've created a standing army in labor.
Right.
Okay. You see my point? So we have, you know, not just a standing army, we have a plethora of standing armies, and the money that they're spending on all of these powers are unconstitutional. The people that are working in these offices are not, they don't have legitimate jobs. This was mm-hmm. all done fraudulently. So the debt or the money they're spending is fraud.
Right.
Okay.
You mean the money they're creating to spend, right?
The money they're creating, the fact that they're writing these checks, these retirement plans, this is all fraud against the American people. Mm-hmm. This, you know, people, what I am saying, people do not like to hear. As a matter of fact, people take real offense when they hear, hey, this guy's talking about my retirement.
Right.
Right. And so, you know, But I'm not. It goes right down to that. You know, you're not supposed to hate the messenger. You may not like the message, but that's the truth. And so when are we going to start talking about the truth? Because don't sit there. I mean, as somebody that says, oh, well, we've got a financial problem, and then say, well, but we got to continue maintaining this financial problem, and we have to allow ourselves to slip away and let China take over and let the globalists come and just take our country from us. No.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is why, you know, there's a lot to do. There's really, but this is so simple because I go back and forth on, you know, on the simplicity of all of this. If they don't have the power, they don't have the right to spend the money. I mean, everything is all based on the enumerated powers of the Constitution. So anyway, all right. So forgive me for ranting.
Well, I asked the question.
Yeah. Right. It's okay. It's okay. So go ahead.
Okay. So I'm going to start where I left off.
Sure.
And in declaring that this Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land, end quote. This has at last been conceded that though it is explicit enough, yet it gives to Congress no further powers than those already enumerated. Those that first said it gave to Congress the power of superseding the state governments cannot persist in it, for no person can, with a tolerable face, read the clauses over and infer that such may be the consequence.
There you go. Closes that argument on that, right?
Yeah, right. He does.
Okay.
He slams that shut. Okay. Provision is made that Congress shall have power to prohibit the importation of slaves after the year 1808. But the gentleman in opposition accused this system of a crime because it has not prohibited it at once. Excuse me. I suspect those gentlemen are not well acquainted with the business of the diplomatic body, or they would know that an agreement might be made that did not perfectly accord with the will and pleasure of any one person. Instead of finding fault with what has been gained, I'm happy to see a disposition in the United States to do so much.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so so he's kind of just going through and kind of slapping these things, because bottom line, you know, there may be a personal opinion that they should have ended slavery, period. That's what they should have done. But again, it goes down to the body politic, where these men in this situation felt keeping the Union was more important. And because Wilson, we read this earlier, that Wilson basically lays out that slavery is going to be dismantled because of the shutting down of the slave trade and so forth. So anyway, keep going.
Well, instead of people thinking of not understanding it, thinking of the Constitution as a slave promoting document, it was just the opposite. It
right.
led the way for bringing slavery to a close.
Right.
No, the Articles of Confederation didn't do that.
No,
but the Constitution
correct.
Did.
Right. Now, under the Articles of Confederation, there was a thing called the Northwest Ordinance.
Right.
And the Northwest Ordinance was to not allow slavery to persist into any new state joining the Union. And I think it laid out specifically, because I think that there were some territories that were a part of a state that it would be perpetuated into, such as like Mississippi and Alabama, because those states didn't exist yet, but they were a part of, I think, the Georgia, Carolina colonies as they projected across. And so the Northwest Ordinance kind of touched this, you know, the shutting down of slavery. However, in the Constitution, the federal government just had the responsibility, and under the Constitution, they basically made it as a self-determination that the states would choose for themselves. They had no authority to dictate how states would join the Union. And so this was, if you want to call it political theatrics, whatever, this was done because they felt the necessity of maintaining the three southern states in the Union.
Okay.
And that's why they did it. And so I understand how they did it. And actually, we have evidence that Wilson was right. And, you know, because we've talked about this before. I mean, in previous conversations, Paul, we've talked about slavery. And I've asserted that the Constitution by design had this. And I mean, Wilson was saying that by design, that we would get to a point where slavery would be eradicated because the states would actually, via an amendment, you know, completely undo it. And so we saw that happening, but nobody foresaw the Missouri Compromise and the you know, this evil that kind of came through. Folks, if you want to understand, you know, how this evil kind of came through, it had more to do with the lawyers and the justice system becoming more perverted. Because when we looked at, and I talked about this in my first book, I laid out, if you look at where all these federal judges were getting into the federal court system, most of these were Southern or slavery mentality judges. And so these were the ones that were getting appointed. And they understood that if they wanted to protect this institution, they had to have people in these halls of justice to do just that. And this is why we see the calculations of, if we want the nation to go in a certain direction, we need judges that will give us the decisions or, you know, bend and violate the Constitution so that, you know, everybody just has to accept it because it was done by the justices, or I should say the federal courts. And this is why I've gone into this in recently and in other times where I've just ranted on and on. The federal courts do not have jurisdiction over anything not enumerated. So when we look at some of the stuff that they've put upon us, whether it be the Roe v. Wade, even the Plessy v. Ferguson, right? So, you know, the separate but equal type of crap. They couldn't, the rulings that they made were not in line with the Constitution. There were no powers for them to even hear those cases. Bottom line, they should have said, hey, states, you know, the 14th Amendment keeps you from making any law that abridges privileges and immunities of any U.S. citizen. All are to have equal access, period.
Right.
Right. And so, but they allowed these Jim Crow laws and these games to be played because they were appointing evil men. And that's what happens when evil men, you know, take, and this is what happens when a nation falls asleep and doesn't go, you know, because I've said this goes down to the body whole. Our entire government, our entire system is dependent upon the body, which the body is the people. We have to hold our public servants accountable. We have a system that allows us to do that by these oaths and by the rule of law. You know, by this, we finally got the 14th Amendment, Section 3, that gives us the ability to remove them if they violate their oath. Many states in their constitution have this power now. And so Missouri has that power. Wyoming has that power. And South Dakota has that power. And so we need to get more states to have that power. And I'm sure that there are more states. I just don't have all the state constitutions done yet. But my point is, and then we can get back to reading again. My point is this, is that if we are to, if we have all the power and authority to clean and heal this body, it was designed by our Creator, just like the human body, that the way it is to function is a natural immune system where all elements, all cells of the body, all people are obligated as citizens of this United States to actually hold their public servants and their governments accountable to the rule of law in a republican form of government. I mean, everything was designed properly. It couldn't have been designed better. It's just that we are failing because we're not holding them accountable.
Wow, I like the way you put that. All cells of the body are obligated.
Yes. Right. I mean, we owe it to each other. Right? Because if we start allowing the bacteria in, then we're decaying the body and destroying the body or perverting the body. And that's what they've been doing. And they've been educating people and perverting cells, but it is not natural in our DNA. And I believe that we have what's necessary in both the DNA and within the law and everything else for us to win this. You know, there's a meme, and I think I mentioned it yesterday or recently, that there's a meme out there that talks about Frodo and Sam Gamgee, where they, you know, Sam was going, this is just a terrible task, you know, kind of talking about this task of carrying the ring. And, why did it have to fall upon us? You know, and that we have to do this, you know, because it does fall upon us. But they're talking about, you know, not being ready and prepared. Folks, I believe that we were born and prepared for this time. I believe that because technology has given us everything we need, we now have the truth, the epiphany, you know, has been clear. We can clearly break the spell of, you know, these, with how these liars and these duplicit and deceitful people have put us into these positions, and we can hold them accountable. Mm-hmm. Let's do it. All we've got to do is start, you know, acting with faith. We only have 7 minutes left, so we won't be getting into Massachusetts today, but keep going.
Sorry. All right, so here we go.
Go ahead.
The next objections have been against the executive power. It is complained of, quote, because the whole of the executive power is not lodged in the presence alone, so that there might be one responsible person. He has the sole powers of pardoning offenses against the United States, and may therefore pardon traitors for treasons committed in consequence of his own ambitious or wicked projects, or those of the Senate, end quote. Observe the contradiction, sir. These two objections. One moment, the system is blamed for not leaving all executive authority to the president alone. The next, it is censured for giving him the sole power to pardon traitors. I'm glad to hear these objections made, because it forebodes an amendment in the body in which amendment is necessary. The President of the United States must nominate to all offices before the persons can be chosen. He here consents and becomes liable. The Executive Council of Pennsylvania appoint officers by ballot, which effectually destroys responsibility. He may pardon offenses, and hence it is inferred that he may pardon traitors for treason committed in consequence of his own ambitious and wicked projects. The Executive Council of Pennsylvania can do the same, for the President of the United States may be impeached before the Senate and punished for his crimes. The Vice President is a useless officer, end quote. Perhaps the government might be executed without him, but there is a necessity of having a person to reside in the Senate to continue a full representation of each state in that body. The Chancellor of England is a judicial officer, yet he sits in the House of Lords. The next objection is against the judicial department. Quote, the judicial power shall be vested in one Supreme Court, end quote. An objection is made that the compensation for the services of the judges shall not be diminished during their continuance in office. And this is contrasted with the compensation of the president, which is to be neither increased nor diminished during the period for which he shall be elected. But that of the judges may be increased, and the judge may hold other offices of a lucrative nature, and his judgment be thereby warped. Do gentlemen not see the reason for this difference is made? Do they not see that the president is appointed but for 4 years, whilst the judges may continue for life, if they shall so long behave themselves well? In the first case, little alteration can happen in the value of money, but in the course of a man's life, a very great one may take place from the discovery of silver and gold mines and the great influx of these metals, in which case an increase of salary may be requisite. A security that their compensation shall not be lessened, or they have to look up to every session for salary, will certainly tend to make these officers more easy and independent.
Okay, so then he goes, I think, into the next argument, right, or what have you. But clearly, he's just basically swatting at all of these different arguments. And he's pointing out, because there's actually been a few times where an argument was framed that complained about two, you know, opposing things, such as the president having the power, you know, full power, doesn't have the full power, but then does have the power. And so he's kind of pointing out, you know, are you even thinking about what you're saying? I mean, you're just dancing on both sides of this. In the long run, and we could just kind of skip down, because I don't think the next section, I think it's important and I'm going to keep it highlighted, but enumerated in jurisdiction is really good. And this just, let's read this one paragraph because we got about 2 minutes left.
Okay, here we go. Enumeration in jurisdiction. That all cases enumerated, except where the Supreme Court has original jurisdiction, quote, they shall have appellate jurisdiction, both as to law and fact, with such exceptions and under such regulations as the Congress shall make, end quote. From this, it is inferred that the trial by jury is not secured, and an objection is set up to the system, because they have jurisdiction between citizens of different states. Regulations under his head are necessary, but the convention could form no one that would have suited each of the United States. It has been a subject of amazement to me to hear gentlemen contend that the verdict of a jury shall be without revision in all cases. Juries are not infallible because they are 12 in number, when the law is so blended with the fact as to be almost inseparable. May not the decision of a jury be erroneous? Yet, notwithstanding this, trial by jury is the best mode that is known. Appellate jurisdiction, sir, is known in the common law, and causes are removed from inferior courts by writs of error to some court of appeal. It is said that the Lord Chancellor in all cases sends down to lower courts when he wants to determine the fact, but that opinion is not well founded because he determines 19 out of 20 without the intervention of any jury. The power to try causes between citizens of different states was thought by some gentlemen invidious, but I apprehend they must see the necessity of it from what has been already said by my honorable colleague.
Okay, and right, he's pointing back to what Wilson had already said regarding the appeals under common law. And he even cited Blackstone, as you even read that part. And so
right.
We're out of time. Paul, we're going to have you right back in our next episode. I love it, and I really appreciate your time. And when we come back, I'll ask you if you have anything, but we're definitely, there's the bumper music, we're going out. So, folks, we're going through these ratification debates just so you understand how the Constitution was defined so that it is no longer arguable. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty.